the military seizure is a direct assault on the country's transition to democracy and the rule of law.
The U.S. speaks out against the coup in Myanmar. This is Friday, the 5th of February, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. You can find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, the coup in Myanmar takes away Facebook. Not all COVID vaccines are openly tested. Pakistan begins its vaccination program, and the postponed Tokyo Olympics is having its problems. All of that and more on today's VOA Asia. The U.S. State Department is condemning the military takeover in Myanmar after police in that country leveled their first formal charge against Myanmar's Aung San Suu Kyi. The charge came to light 2 days after Suu Kyi was placed under house arrest and appeared to be an effort to lend a legal veneer to her detention, though the generals have previously kept her and others locked up for years. State Department spokesman Ned Price called on the Myanmar military to change that situation quickly.
We are aware of reports that State Councilor Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint have been charged with crimes, and the National League for Democracy members of parliament have been ordered to vacate Naypyidaw. We are disturbed, of course, by these reports. We call on the military to immediately release them all and all detained civilian and political leaders, journalists, and detained human rights activists, and to restore the democratically elected government to power. As President Biden has said, the military's seizure is a direct assault on the country's transition to democracy and the rule of law.
The military announced Monday that it would take power for 1 year, accusing Suu Kyi's government of not investigating allegations of voter fraud in recent elections. Suu Kyi's party swept that vote, and the military-backed party did poorly. Myanmar's military government blocked public access to Facebook Thursday amid growing popular resistance to this week's overthrow of the country's civilian government. The Ministry of Communications and Information issued a statement saying the social media giant would be blocked until Sunday in order to keep stability in the country. Telenor Myanmar, the country's leading mobile network operator, confirmed it had been ordered to block Facebook, but said it does not believe that the request is based on necessity and proportionality in accordance with international human rights law. Facebook is the most popular social media platform in Myanmar, used by civilians and military leaders alike. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. Many questions after a WHO team visits the Wuhan virology lab. Britain revokes China's state media's broadcasting license. Australia's Prime Minister said he invited President Biden to visit in September during a very warm and engaging phone call between the two. UNICEF announces a deal with the Serum Institute of India to produce 1.1 billion doses of vaccine at a cost of $3 a dose. Strong winds fan flames of bushfires 50 kilometers northwest of Perth, Australia, destroying 81 homes, and authorities say the threat is far from over. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. The Inter-Parliamentary Union has strongly condemned the military coup in Myanmar, calling it a major setback for democracy and a subversion of the will of the people. IPU membership includes parliamentary bodies from 179 of the world's 193 countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The military coup took place on Monday, the day Myanmar's new 664-member parliament was due to reopen. Military authorities questioned the legitimacy of November's parliamentary election and have detained the country's leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and members of parliament. Secretary General of the Interparliamentary Union, Martin Chungong, says he's worried about the fate of members of parliament, and the IPU has called on the military to respect their integrity. He says the IPU has invested a lot in Myanmar since 2009. He says it has been engaging with military authorities and helping them along the democratic path. He says Myanmar joined the IPU in 2012. Since then, he says, the IPU has worked with Parliament to help it function as a normal democratic body.
As I speak, we do have a team of experts that we're working with the Parliament in order to strengthen different components of that Parliament. Now, their work is in jeopardy. Everything has come unraveled, and I think that the international community should rally together to say and prove that what happened in Myanmar cannot be condoned.
Chungong urges the rapid restoration of constitutional rule. He says Parliament has stopped functioning since the military takeover. He says this has disrupted some important initiatives in which the IPU has been engaged with the MPs. One of particular interest, he says, was an effort begun last year to try to resolve the Rohingya issue.
We had been set to continue this work with the newly elected parliament when this coup happened. And that's why I say it is a big setback for all of us, because we thought we had been making progress along those lines too, at a time when the authorities as such were not very comfortable talking about the Rohingya issue.
Chungong says the IPU has not been able to establish contact with parliamentarians in Myanmar. He says his organization is monitoring the situation closely to see how it evolves. He notes the IPU's governing council is set to meet in regular session next Monday. He says the policymaking body may decide to suspend Myanmar from IPU membership if conditions in the country have not improved. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi urges India's government to resume talks with farmers whose months-long protest over agricultural reforms erupted into violence last week. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Pakistan's government began administering the COVID-19 vaccine this week, saying it's on track to achieve its targets. As VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Islamabad, the opposition says the government is doing too little, too late.
After a year of uncertainty, Pakistan finally began its COVID-19 vaccination campaign, kicking it off with a ceremony attended by the Prime Minister. Late Tuesday, a single dose of China's Sinopharm was administered to a doctor. On Wednesday morning, select hospitals readied their staff in areas designated as inoculation sites. But in many places, delivery of the doses from the government's vaccine bank was delayed by more than half a day without an explanation. In the first phase, the government plans to administer 500,000 doses, all of them donated by China.
The first doses of the vaccine will be provided to the frontline health workers who get the maximum exposure. After that, old people and then the rest of the population.
The opposition has criticized the government's pandemic response, accusing it of taking too long to order the vaccines. In Sindh province, controlled by an opposition party called Pakistan People's Party, the chief minister complained there weren't enough doses for frontline healthcare workers. The government, whose ruling party controls the three remaining provinces, defended its handling of vaccine distribution.
The vaccine is being equitably and fairly distributed among all the provinces. Of the 500,000 doses we have received, no one should think that we are giving away more doses to any one province.
In a country ripe with anti-vaccine conspiracy theories, doctors fear a bigger challenge might be to convince the population to receive their doses.
If Pakistanis don't get vaccinated, they will get repeatedly infected with COVID-19. It can be dangerous for the immune-compromised people, those with chronic diseases, the old people, or those with underlying conditions.
For the next phase, the government says it is getting 17 million doses of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine through the global vaccine pool called COVAX. The U.S. is among the contributors. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News,
Islamabad.
The first vaccines against COVID-19 have gone mostly to wealthier countries. Now, several middle-income countries are getting their shots. Many come from Chinese and Russian drug makers, but critics note that these developers have not been forthcoming with data on their vaccine safety and efficacy. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
An indigenous nurse was the first person to get vaccinated in the Brazilian state of Amazonas. The shot came from Chinese company Sinovac. Tests in Brazil found the vaccine was about 78% effective in preventing life-threatening cases of COVID-19 and about 50% effective overall. Not bad, says Sao Paulo University microbiologist Natalia Pasternak.
We have a good vaccine. It's not the best vaccine in the world. It's not the perfect vaccine, but it's a good vaccine.
But tests elsewhere have been inconsistent. Early data in Turkey show 91% efficacy. In Indonesia, it was 65%. The vaccine's actual efficacy is a mystery because Sinovac has not publicly released the clinical trial results. That's concerning, says Vanderbilt University infectious disease professor William Schaffner.
There's an old saying in clinical research, in God we trust, all others must provide data. And we would certainly like to see the data.
Another Chinese company, Sinopharm, says its vaccine is 79% effective, but it has not released its data either. Several countries are welcoming the Chinese vaccines anyway, at least in part because most other vaccines have been snapped up by wealthier countries. Brazil's Butantan Institute tested the Sinovac vaccine. Director Dimas Covas says working with the Chinese company was the right move.
Because if we hadn't, we wouldn't have millions of doses on the shelves ready to be used.
The two Chinese vaccines were made using techniques that have been around for decades. The flu and rabies vaccines are made the same way, but that does not guarantee they are safe and effective for everyone, Schaffner says.
We're sure they are effective to some degree. Exactly how effective they are, particularly in older patients, who obviously are the persons who are going to be more severely affected, is something that we'd like to know a great deal more about.
Vaccines from drug companies Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech appear to be more effective than the Chinese shots. But those vaccines need to be kept extremely cold. That makes them hard to deliver in many parts of the world, notes Johns Hopkins University vaccine expert William Moss.
They're not the ideal vaccine, and particularly, you know, for many low and middle income countries.
The Chinese vaccines are stable at refrigerator temperatures. So too is Russia's Sputnik V. Like the Chinese companies, the Russian developers have been criticized for distributing the vaccine without sharing test results. But on Tuesday, they published a study in the medical journal The Lancet showing it was more than 91% effective. That puts it in the top tier, Moss says.
This is what we wanted to see. This is very encouraging, I think, data, and really good for the world to have another vaccine.
Welcome news in Argentina, Hungary, and elsewhere, where Sputnik V shots are already being given. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
This news from VOA Asia. Canada says Hong Kong graduates of Canadian universities could apply for a new category of three-year work permit next week and express fresh concern about China's clampdown on the former British territory. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. The coronavirus pandemic is not the only problem to plague the Tokyo Olympics. The Games have also gone massively over budget. It's intensifying calls for big changes in how the Olympics are held, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
You probably already know the Tokyo Olympics were delayed a year because of the coronavirus. But you may not know about the long list of other problems the Games have faced, problems that are causing a lot of frustration in Japan. There was the expensive proposal for Tokyo's main Olympic stadium, which was ditched after it was widely mocked for resembling a bike helmet, a spaceship, and a turtle. There was the original Tokyo Olympics logo, which was scrapped after accusations it plagiarized the emblem of a theater in Belgium. Just this week, the president of the Tokyo Organizing Committee faced calls to resign over his recent comments that women talk too much in board meetings. And of course, there was the coronavirus postponement, which organizers say will cost nearly $3 billion.
Things have really spiraled out of control, and that was before COVID.
That is Victor Matheson, a sports economist. He estimates Japan will have spent about $35 billion on the Olympics, shattering the original $7.5 billion budget. But Tokyo is not alone. According to a recent Oxford study, every Olympics since 1960 has gone over budget by an average of 172%. The situation has added more urgency to calls for radical changes in how cities host the Olympics. Many now see the Games as a debt trap, leaving vacant or underused sports venues and other facilities when the Games wrap up. That helps explain the steady decline in the number of countries bidding to host the Olympics. Whereas the 2004 Olympics attracted 11 bids, that number dwindled to 5 for the 2020 event. For the 2026 Games, there were just 2 candidates. So what can be done about it? One person with some suggestions is economist Andrew Zimbalist. He proposes naming permanent host cities for the summer and winter games, or designating several rotating sites.
So that you don't have to rebuild the Olympic Shangri-La every 4 years or some other place in the world, which is financially very costly and it's environmentally costly.
Zimbalist also says the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, should contribute more money, such as television revenue, to cities hosting the games.
It used to be the case that the IOC shared the bulk of television revenue with the host city, 70-80% of it. These days, they're sharing close to 20%.
In an email to VOA, the IOC defended its approach, saying it recently undertook reforms meant to discourage cities from building unnecessary venues. It said for the 2024, 2026, and 2028 games, more than 90% of the venues will be existing or temporary. And it said it was open to the games being held in different cities, regions, or countries. But Zimbalist says for Tokyo, that may be too late.
They were hoping for a public relations boost from hosting the games. Maybe they can rescue some of that. It's pretty clear that $30, $35 billion investment is going to waste one way or the other. There's not much they can do about it.
For the Tokyo Games, most of the bill will fall to Japanese taxpayers. And they do not seem thrilled. Bill Gallo, BOA News, Seoul.
Happening in Asia, a group of anti-China activists campaigning for human rights in Tibet and support for ethnic Uyghurs called Thursday for a boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. Stay with us for the latest news from and about Asia at voanews.com and all of our digital platforms. Strict COVID-19 measures are being reintroduced in the state of Victoria after an Australian Open hotel worker tested positive. Up to 600 tennis players, officials, and support staff have been told to isolate and be screened, while warm-up matches for next week's Grand Slam in Melbourne have been canceled. Australia has recorded 28,829 COVID-19 cases and 909 deaths since the pandemic began. That according to official government figures. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
Caution has underpinned Australia's response to COVID-19. News that a 26-year-old worker at a hotel used by the Australian Open has tested positive prompted authorities to take swift action. Several hundred players and officials have been sent into isolation in Melbourne and must return a negative coronavirus test before they can resume their preparations for next week's tournament. Victoria Premier Daniel Andrews.
About 500-600 people that are either players and officials and others who are casual contacts, they will be isolating until they get a negative test. So it may have an impact on the lead-up event, but at this stage, there's no impact to the tournament proper.
Andrews added that there was no need for people to panic because Victoria was adept at containing coronavirus outbreaks following a marathon four-month lockdown last year. Warm-up matches at Melbourne Park have been suspended Thursday as a precaution. Australian player Nick Kyrgios says while he supports the decision, he believes some of his colleagues won't.
I'm not going to complain. You know, it's not about me. My mum's incredibly sick. You know, if she gets COVID, then do you know what I mean? There's too much risk in all this. I don't understand why it's so hard for tennis players to understand. Like, you're just a tennis player. It's not life and death like this is.
Restrictions also apply to the broader community in the state of Victoria. Masks are mandatory and private gatherings in homes are limited to 15 people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The United States should extend the May 1st deadline for pulling all of its troops from Afghanistan and make force cuts contingent on progress in peace talks, as well as by the Taliban in reducing violence and containing al-Qaeda. A bipartisan report to Congress said that Wednesday. Brian Wood has more.
A May deadline is fast approaching for the U.S. to withdraw all troops from Afghanistan. But a bipartisan report delivered to Congress on Wednesday says that would be too early. The U.S. agreed to pull its troops from Afghanistan by May 1st in a 2020 agreement with the Taliban. However, the Afghanistan Study Group says a military drawback should be contingent on peace talks. U.S. officials say the Taliban has maintained ties with al-Qaeda and talks have stalled. The Taliban denies the affiliation and has threatened to resume attacks on foreign forces if they remain in Afghanistan past the May 1st deadline. This new report, however, warns withdrawing all U.S. troops could lead to civil war, destabilize the region, and reinvigorate al-Qaeda. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price responded on Wednesday, saying negotiations with the Afghan government are ongoing.
No decisions about our force posture have been made. We are committed, as I said, to supporting the diplomatic process, and we're committed to ensuring that Afghanistan never again provides a base for terrorist attacks against the United States, our partners, or our interests.
Report co-chair and retired Marine General Joseph Dunford told reporters the study has been shared with the Biden White House. Former President Donald Trump ordered a drawback of U.S. soldiers by last month, even as violence in Afghanistan surged. Some lawmakers, like GOP Senator Lindsey Graham, took issue with Trump's decision. In a statement, he praised the Wednesday report, saying, quote, "We took our eye off Afghanistan, and that can never happen again."
That was Reuters correspondent Brian Wood. Volunteering in your community is not a new idea, but for one Indonesian scuba diver, his volunteer work is dangerous and sometimes terrifying. VOA's Randy Wikasana reports from Jakarta.
Hendra, a journalist, is also a licensed diver. When a Sriwijaya Air jet crashed in the Java Sea on January 9th, killing all 62 people on board, he volunteered to help find debris and recover the bodies of victims.
Members of the Indonesian Divers Rescue Team are required to spend a minimum of 4 days helping. Along with a search and rescue team, we are a part of a humanitarian mission. I'm a journalist, so I try to avoid the impression of being a tourist amidst the disaster and approach the work as a serious operation.
His team consists of a lawyer, a bread shop owner, two another journalists. They took part in the 13-day search mission. The Indonesian Divers Rescue Team, or IDRT, has been involved in several other search missions, including the 2014 AirAsia plane crash in Indonesia. Hendra says there's more to the job than just finding bodies and wreckage.
We need to especially treat the victims as humane as possible. They are not just numbers. We often see the news, one bag, two bags, three bags of body parts are discovered. They are not just numbers. They are human. Then treat them as how humans wish to be treated.
About 360 divers were involved in the initial search of the Boeing 737, which crashed near an island in the Java Sea. The search to find the black box containing the cockpit voice recorder is still ongoing, a key piece of equipment that will help investigators figure out the cause of the crash. From Jakarta, Randy Wicaksana, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. And you can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Heimel, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Please stay safe and enjoy the day.